Beatles were away on tour for much of 1964, and in August they set off again for 2 months in America, the longest, most ambitious and most exhausting tour they ever did. Screaming fans were everywhere, invading the stage, invading their hotels, invading their lives. I think the Beatles were quite frightened of their fans. I was frightened of them too. I used to get hateful letters, particularly from American girls. The fans might not have liked my relationship with George, but the media were delighted with it, and I was more in demand than ever. I made TV commercials for Dop shampoo, in which I drove through a car wash in an open-topped car, and another for Smith's crisps, and I did masses of modelling jobs for magazines and newspapers. I used to count the days until George was due back. Once he got back very early in the morning and jumped into bed to wake me, smelling of aeroplanes and exotic long-haul flights. The fans were making life intolerable for us, and not only when the Beatles were performing. None of them could go into or out of their flats without being grabbed, mauled, and begged for autographs at any time of day or night. Brian decided they'd needed to move, and asked the band's accountant to find suitable houses. His home was in Weybridge, Surrey, 30 miles southwest of London, so it was to that area that they migrated. John and Ringo bought grand houses in St George's Hill, an exclusive estate that housed the rich and famous in safety and seclusion. George didn't like that idea and chose instead a modern four-bedroom bungalow in Esher called Kinfauns, about 20 minutes' drive from the others. Paul bought a house in St John's Wood in London, convenient for the EMI recording studios in Abbey Road. Kinfauns had been built in the early 1960s in what had previously been the walled vegetable garden of Claremont Girls' School. With the addition of a 14-foot high gate, it was very private and the house was surrounded by 3/4 acre of garden. I was living in Ovington Mews when George bought Kinfauns, but I helped him furnish it. We went off and bought big black leather sofas and other furniture from the Habitat shop, which Terence Conran had recently opened in the Fulham Road. When the lease on Ovington Mews came up for renewal, I moved into a little flat that George rented for me in South Audley Street in Mayfair. He was still doing a lot of touring. During the first 3 years that I knew him, the Beatles averaged 3 long tours in each, one British, one American, and one that took in several other countries. And when they weren't touring, they were recording. Eventually, I abandoned the flat in London, where I was lonely on my own, and moved in with George. London was only 45 minutes away, easy to get to for work or play. I wasn't a good cook, but I was always quite enthusiastic. I tried to make things I imagined boys from the north would like, shepherd's pie, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. And then George and I became vegetarian, which gave me a whole new interest. Being vegetarian at that time was quite a challenge. There was nothing ready-made that you could cook with minimal preparation. I had to create things myself and discovered I loved doing it. I cooked for our friends and our families. I had hundreds of cookery books. For a while I read nothing else. I was vegetarian for about 7 years, but George remained so until the day he died. We spent a lot of time in the kitchen. It was the heart of the house. I remember George sitting at the table with his guitar writing a song that became My Sweet Lord. When it came out as a single and went to number one, he was taken to court because an American group called the Chiffons had written a song called He's So Fine, and the song's music publisher claimed that George had stolen it. It was tricky for him. I knew he'd written it. I was there when he was working on it, but the judge found him guilty of subconscious plagiarism. After that, we never had a radio playing in the house in case he was unconsciously influenced by a song he had heard. His guitars were always left around the house, and in any spare moment he would pick one up and play. I loved listening to him, loved the sound of the guitar in the house. He was always happiest when he was being creative. As a rule, George didn't want to meet new people unless they were musicians. One evening we were invited to dinner by a Mr. Angardi, who ran the Asian Music Circle in London. He wanted George to meet a sitar player called Ravi Shankar. Ravi was well known in classical music circles and a hero in his own country, India. They talked music all evening and George was awestruck. Soon afterwards, Ravi came to Kinfauns to give George a sitar lesson. He and Ravi became friends, and a couple of months later, Ravi invited us to India, where he would be our guide for spiritual, musical and cultural lessons. We flew to Bombay and I was overwhelmed by the noise, the heat and the mass of humanity. We stayed in the Taj Hotel, a very grand Victorian building opposite the gateway of India. Ravi arranged yoga classes every morning to teach George how to sit and hold the sitar, followed by several hours of lessons and practice with him and his other students. Then after about a month, we travelled together around India. Among many others, we met Ravi's spiritual guru, Tat Baba, who explained the law of karma to us both, the law of action and reaction, or cause and effect. We visited many jewels of India with Ravi, the Taj Mahal, Jodhpur, Jaipur, Agra, Delhi, temples with ancient carvings of gods and goddesses. We met some holy men who are more than 100 years old and sadhus who live in abject poverty. Ravi was respected all over India. His students would bow down at his feet and I found his concerts intensely moving. There was something profoundly spiritual about the whole experience.